That took place in 1955 when Lolo was 20 years old. There, in Lolo's hometown, the heads of state and senior officials of 29 newly independent Asian and African countries met to consider their future. President Sukarno of Indonesia was the host, and in attendance were Jawaharlal Nehru from India, Kwame Nkrumah from Ghana, and Jomo Kenyatta. The main thrust of Bandung was a joint declaration that these countries did not want to align with either the West or the Soviet Union. They wanted to go their own way, sometimes called the Third Way. Bandung gave rise a few years later to the so-called non-aligned movement. Sotoro would surely have sympathized with the objectives of the Bandung Conference. As a child, he grew up under colonialism, and his parents endured the hardship and humiliation of an especially severe form of forced labor imposed by the Dutch. The historian K.M. Panikkar writes in Asia and Western Dominance, "The Dutch alone, of the European nations in the East, carried out a policy which systematically reduced a whole population to the status of plantation labor, without recognizing any moral or legal obligation to them." His father and oldest brother were killed during the revolutionary struggle, when the native Indonesians fought for freedom from the Netherlands, and the Dutch army burned Sotoro's family home. Eventually, the war ended, and the Sotoros returned to rebuild their home. Like Barack Obama Sr., Lolo Sotoro got a basic education in his homeland and then came to Hawaii to study. The two ended up at the same university and married the same woman. Sotoro was recalled to Indonesia in 1966 when the Sukarno government decided it needed the services of its citizens living and studying abroad. A year later, Sotoro's new wife, Anne, joined him in Jakarta with her son. Sotoro became a kind of surrogate father to Obama, who writes affectionately about him. "With Lolo, I learned how to eat small green chili peppers raw with dinner. And away from the dinner table, I was introduced to dog meat, snake meat, and roasted grasshopper." Lolo explained that a man took on the powers of whatever he ate. "One day soon," he promised, "he would bring home a piece of tiger meat for us to share." This was Obama's Indonesia, exotic, unpredictable, a feast for the senses. The family lived in a Jakarta neighborhood that was more like a village than today's sprawling metropolis. While the Sotoro family lived in a brick house with a tiled roof, many of the houses were bamboo huts, and electricity had just arrived a few years earlier. We know Sotoro shared with Obama his sufferings at the hands of the Dutch, because Obama writes about it. Sotoro also taught Obama that one should be tough in the world and not whine about one's situation. Obama was a bit of a whiner. Contrary to the lean, trim Obama that we now see, Obama as a young boy was rather round and overweight, and he was often teased in school not so much for being dark-skinned — many Indonesians are just as dark-skinned — but mostly for being fat. Obama was sensitive to being overweight, and when the kids brought that to his attention, he would yell back, "Kurang, kurang." The word in Indonesian means cheater, and what Obama was saying, in effect, was no fair. Obama has subsequently portrayed himself as fluent in Indonesian, but his friends at the time recall that he could barely speak the language. One of the few words he knew was kurang. Obama's stepfather, Lolo, knew how tough it was to grow up in Indonesia, and he informed Obama about the importance of learning the arts of combat and survival, how to make one's way in a cruel world. For Sotoro, this meant learning how to throw a punch and also how to make compromises and cut deals when one had to. Paradoxically, Sotoro's anti-colonial experience took him in a very different direction than that of Barack Obama Sr. Over time, Sotoro became more pro-American and anti-communist. When the left-leaning Sukarno was overthrown in a coup by the right-wing General Suharto, Sotoro joined the military in its campaign against communist rebels in the countryside. Then Sotoro took a job in the oil business, and he relocated the family to a nicer neighborhood. Dutch colonists used to live there, and many Japanese moved in during their occupation of Indonesia in the Second World War. When the Sotoros moved in, the area was full of diplomats, Indonesian businessmen, and white Europeans and Americans living abroad. Sotoro began to hang out with these white expats. All of this alienated Sotoro's bohemian wife, Obama's mother. She admired Sukarno for his decision to nationalize the major industries and hated Suharto for his pro-Western and pro-American inclinations. Anne was particularly offended at the way rich foreigners of Sotoro's acquaintance talked about their servants and showed no interest in the indigenous cultural traditions of Indonesia. As Obama writes, "She taught me to disdain the blend of ignorance and arrogance that too often characterizes Americans abroad." In time, she began to view her second husband as a kind of sellout, somehow lacking the authenticity that she continued to admire in Obama's father. Basically, she fell in love with the old anti-colonial Lolo and came to detest the new pro-American Lolo. Is this speculation? I'll let Obama tell the story. She had expected it to be difficult, this new life of hers. Before leaving Hawaii, she had tried to learn all she could about Indonesia, the history of colonialism, first the Dutch for over three centuries, then the Japanese during the war, seeking control over vast stores of oil, metal, and timber, the fight for independence after the war, and the emergence of a freedom fighter named Sukarno as the country's first president. A poor country, underdeveloped, utterly foreign. This much she had known. She was prepared for the dysentery and fevers, the cold water baths and having to squat over a hole in the ground to pee, the electricity going out every few weeks, the heat and endless mosquitoes. Nothing more than inconveniences, really. And anyway, that was part of what had drawn her to Lolo after Barack had left, the promise of something new and important, helping her husband rebuild a country in a charged and challenging place beyond her parents' reach. Still, something had happened between her and Lolo. In Hawaii, he had been so full of life, so eager with his plans. At night, when they were alone, he would tell her about growing up as a boy during the war, watching his father and eldest brother leave to join the Revolutionary Army, hearing the news that both had been killed and everything lost, the Dutch army setting their house aflame, their flights into the countryside, his mother selling her gold jewelry a piece at a time in exchange for food. Things would be changing now that the Dutch had been driven out, Lolo had told her. He would return to teach at the university, be a part of that change. The problem, Obama writes, is that he didn't talk that way anymore. He had sold out to power. Power, the word fixed in my mother's mind like a curse. She became convinced that power had taken Lolo and that power was taking her son. Obama tells us that she sent him back to Hawaii because she wanted the time and the freedom to finish her dissertation. Also, there were greater opportunities for her son in America. But Obama's own account gives us a different reason. After all, she was quite willing to deprive her son of opportunities by bringing him to Indonesia. The main reason she sent him back to America was to prevent him from being corrupted by Lolo. She considered Lolo a sellout to the power structure, and she wanted to prevent her son from making the same compromise. In fact, she wanted her son to be influenced not by her second husband, but by her first. Now we see how Obama's biological father, even in absentia, had so much influence. His influence was in large part transmitted by the mother. She was Obama Sr.'s first convert. More speculation? Not according to Obama Jr. He describes fights between his mother and Lolo, with her accusing him of being a sellout and Lolo pleading that there was nothing wrong with hanging out with the white people because these were her own people. Obama writes that my mother's voice would rise to almost a shout, "They are not my people." And at that point, Obama tells us, Anne began to run down Lolo to her son. Incredibly, she started comparing Lolo unfavorably with Barack Sr. I say incredibly because Barack Sr. was the one who abandoned his son who was being raised, without complaint, by Lolo. Obama writes that when his mother's frustration mounted with Lolo, she had only one ally in all this, and that was the distant authority of my father. Increasingly, she would remind me of his story, how he had grown up poor, in a poor country, in a poor continent, how his life had been hard as anything that Lolo might have known. He hadn't cut corners, though, or played all the angles. He was diligent and honest, no matter what it cost him. He had led his life according to principles that demanded a different kind of toughness, principles that promised a higher form of power. I would follow his example, my mother decided. I had no choice. It was in the genes. Not surprisingly, Anne soon divorced Lolo, who eventually married an Indonesian woman. Lolo died in Jakarta in 1987. Barack Obama was 10 when he returned to Hawaii to live with his grandparents. It was here that Barack Obama Sr. made his one and only visit to see his son and dazzle him and his classmates. Both Obama's African father and his Indonesian stepfather were products of the great anti-colonial struggles of their day. But they went in different directions, and Obama's mother made sure that for her son, she chose the direction of his biological father. And her preference sunk in. Obama writes, "I realized, perhaps for the first time, how even in his absence, his strong image had given me some bulwark on which to grow up, an image to live up to or disappoint." It is obvious that these youthful experiences made an intense and vivid impression because the memories were just as powerful many years later when Obama wrote about them. It seems obvious that they still continue to stir his heart and guide his actions. We are, even now, living with the consequences.